Hello and welcome to Sex, Psychics and Psychedelics, Discovering Inner Liberation. My name is Banana Jane Garnett. I'm a licensed psychotherapist, a lover of freedom and a relentless explorer of the mind. Please come join me on my journey in hot pursuit of inner illumination and liberation. For more about me, you can find me at The Banana Jane on Instagram. Now let's dive in.
Celeste Hirschman is a San Francisco-based sex therapist. She is the co-creator of the Somatica Method and the co-founder of the Somatica Institute. Celeste received an MA in Human Sexuality Studies from San Francisco State University and a BA in Women's Studies from UCSC. In her teaching and coaching, Celeste draws on her extensive training in attachment psychology, sociology, gender studies, and body-based modalities like Hakomi. She uses these embodied learning principles to help students and clients tap into their own somatica wisdom to deepen their experiences of pleasure and to realize their full personal and professional potential. Welcome, Celeste. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I guess I identify as a sex coach, not a sex therapist, but everything else was totally true.
And, Okay.
Yeah. And okay. I train coaches in my method also.
So, okay, well, let's start there. Sex coach, sex therapist. Can you tell us the difference?
Yeah, sex therapy, you have to go through and you have to get a master's in marriage and family therapy, and then you specialize. But the coaching that we do actually is much more experiential. So it doesn't just stay within the boundaries of traditional therapy. And I found to help people have better intimacy, you actually have to be able to practice some things in real time, like touch or sharing erotic stories or turn-ons or something like that. And that's not really something that a therapist can do with their client.
Yeah, God damn it. I've noticed that in my own practice. Just as I want to share an erotic fantasy with a client, I have to close my mouth. It's so interesting.
Exactly. So you know, we collaborate a lot of times with therapists because we need to send sometimes we need to send our clients to therapists, and sometimes they want to send theirs to us.
Yeah. So with the touching, I'm imagining you might be guiding them. Do you also do hands-on work or not?
Yeah, it's two-way touching, but we keep our clothes on. We're not touching genitals. But in order to teach things like passion, you know, like we have this up against the wall exercise where you sort of learn how to like passionately hold somebody's body and throw them up against the wall and caress the hair. So I would be like touching back in that situation, just so that it's more realistic than just sort of like sitting there.
Right. So you would try being the client and you would be the, so you would try both positions in that?
I do demonstrate. So I'll like push the person up against the wall and grab them and teach them. And then they'll try it on me often multiple times with feedback, or I play something called the animal game with my clients, which is like a disinhibition game to help people find their inner animal before they learn all these techniques and get up in their head. It has to be like, you know, you have to let out that part of yourself.
Okay, I need this. I think I need this today, actually. I mean, I don't know if I'm going to be an animal on screen, but let's, like, tell me how you do that. Do you try on different animals or what?
I would love to play the animal game with you. It's done usually in person because we're actually, like, rolling around on the floor together. But yeah, as soon as I get in the same room, animal game it is.
Okay, we'll get our calendars out at the end of this. Book me in your first available, please. I've got a few animals already coming to mind. So,
like, which ones? What animals are you?
Well, you know, I love all the, like, I like the sort of the tigers, and I like sort of also I like bouncy animals. So I'm thinking of a tiger. I'm thinking of a rabbit. Maybe a caterpillar. Is that an animal? I don't know. But I
counts anything that counts.
It makes me think. As a kid, I used to like play little caterpillar games in our sleeping bags. Grew up in Scotland, so we'd spend a lot of time in sleeping bags in the rain, and there would, you know, be a lot of games around that. But
so
I love that idea.
Like, if you're a tiger right now, like,
yeah,
we can do it online. You want to bring? I'll bring my cougar because that's what I am.
Okay. Well, I think this. I'm at a disadvantage here. You know how to play this game. You show me your cougar, okay?
Let's see. Fair enough.
Okay. I mean, how do you do it?
I just want to rip you to shreds. I want to eat you alive.
Oh my Oh my God, I'm so excited. In that position, I definitely was something. Then I was like, I don't know, like a little bunny or something, but slightly excited about being eaten, which is, you know, maybe something else to look into. So I love that. So you just play. Is that you start out playing with couples to?
We play, but we play with erotic energy.
Okay. So even with the animals, you're saying this is, we're using the animal to get to erotic energy, like the energy of eating or pouncing or.
The energy of passion.
The energy of passion. I love that.
Because passion is like an out of control. Like, I can't wait to get my hands all over you. I want to bite you and kiss you and smell you and lick you and taste you, you know? So that bringing in the animal kind of invites that energy.
Well, it's also, as you say that, it's also, you know, it's love and that the, you know, we all say that to kids, don't we? Babies. Oh, I just want to eat you. You know, anything that you love so much, you want to devour, eat. And it's such a, it's a nice thing as an adult, you know, wanting to be eaten. It's not always, you know, it's not the same as when you're a baby where everyone wants to eat you as an adult. Yes. Some people.
Yes, that's the one world I want to live in.
Oh, you want to eat me? Thank you. You know, oh my God, that's so funny. By the way, what is, I keep meaning to ask you this, what is Hakomi?
Oh, Hakomi is a mindfulness-based therapy that was developed by a man named Ron Kurtz. And it's just a way of, it really helps you bring in more like embodiment and somatics into a therapeutic practice. So a lot of therapists take it, but also people just train in that method.
Okay. So the somatica method, let's get a working description of that. And then we can kind of go into more nitty gritty.
Yeah, the somatica method is an embodied, experiential, pleasure-based method that really helps people practice in real time with authentic intimacy. So we're not doing like role-playing. It's like, if you're my client, Jane, and I want to practice with you, I'm going to say, you know, like, I'm going to share my, like, yes, like, I'm going to share my feelings authentically. So when you smile like that, my whole body lights up, right? So I'm not pretending to be your partner or something. We're actually practicing intimacy in real time, whether it be emotional or erotic.
And it's going both ways. So you're saying that to me and I'll be like, oh, when you praise me like that, I just feel like the best girl in the world.
Exactly.
We say things like that we would feel embarrassed to say sometimes, maybe to someone else.
Yeah. And to be able to ask for that too, because, you know, if you know that me praising you is what makes you feel good, then it's good to be able to tell people. Like, luckily, a lot of the young guys who I'm dating, like, they know about love languages. And I'm like, okay, well, I am words of appreciation, or words, I can't remember exactly how they call it. But
yeah, words of affirmation, I think.
Affirmation,
yeah.
That's
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
And I want, you know, I'm like, literally, I'll just say to someone on a date, like, so if you have anything nice to say about me, I'm available for that, right? Like, that really gets me.
That's brave, I think, to be able to say that, don't you?
Definitely. It took me a long time, but it's like, ultimately, that's what turns me on. So what's the point, you know?
Well, of course, you're going to receive a lot more kind words after that, I would say, for the most part. Although, don't some people freeze? Fingers crossed. Yeah, they're like, oh, well, check, please. No, what the, I mean, do you?
Some people have like big, like, well, I need it. It needs to be authentic, or they have like freedom wounds. So if you tell them what to do, they don't want to do it or something like that. So, if they're asking and saying like, these are my love languages, what are yours? Then I'm assuming that they want to find that out because they want to give me mine.
Well, you know, I do think that what you're saying, like this, you're looking at, and you're with males, right? So we're looking at a younger sort of breed of males in San Francisco, right? So, I mean, we're talking about probably the most enlightened pocket of males you've managed to either stumble upon or cleverly find. So it definitely is not always the case. And it's actually bringing to mind an ongoing battle I had with my ex-husband, excuse me, ex-husband, but I think this is valuable to share, which is that, you know, there were those moments where I just wanted this kind of comfort. And I was talking to, through words, and I was talking to a girlfriend about it at the time. And she said, oh, you just want good girl, poor baby. And we laughed about it, but I was like, yeah, basically that's what I want. It's kind of that there thing. And so I said to him, you know, it's basically, you don't worry, you can just kind of shine it on, just do a version of Good Girl, Poor Baby. And he was like, that is so patronizing. That is so sort of disrespectful to yourself to even ask for that, you know? I mean, we didn't get anywhere on it because he thought it was inauthentic. If he didn't feel it, if he didn't feel I was a baby or a good girl, maybe as well, then why should he say it?
Well, not only that though, but he shamed you for even wanting it. I mean, I'm fine if somebody says to me like, that doesn't feel authentic and I need to wait until I actually have the feeling to say it. And I'm like, great, thank you for telling me who you are. But if they say there's something wrong with what I want, then I'm like, you're totally shaming me right now. And I don't respond to shame. Like, if I want to be called a good girl, which really turns me on in bed, by the way,
yeah,
or if I want to be cuddled and held and soothed when I'm sad, like those are wonderful things that many people need, you know, not everybody, but I just hate this one size fits all approach to life. Like if I think that I don't want it, like you're not supposed to want it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, shame has got to be such a huge part of this work. Tell me about that. How much does it come up? Where does it come up and how do you deal with it?
It comes up almost constantly. You know, everybody in the back of their mind, am I normal? Is this okay? Is it appropriate? I shouldn't, you know, all of this, but we're ruthless de-shamifiers in Somatica. We made up a word, de-shamify, and we de-shamify everywhere we see it. You know?
How do we do it? How do we bust shame? What are the techniques?
Even just right there, like I said, I named it.
Your ex-husband shamed you.
I say, what's wrong with those beautiful desires? They're wonderful. I also have them, you know? So one way to de-shamify, if it's true, is to say you also have them, or you can say, I hate society for like putting this negativity on you and these expectations, or, you know, there's a lot of, we teach like the tools of de-shamifying in the training.
I love that. I think we all need de-shamifying, and there's this idea around shame that I've been carrying. I'm not sure if it's right, but the idea that shame comes into existence in the sort of in the social construct, it happens between two people, and therefore it can only be dismantled in the social construct. So it takes two people to make it, and it takes two people to break it. So I don't know if we can, I mean, I think we can do shadow work with ourselves. We can notice sort of intrapsychically like, oh, you know, this shadow came up then, and what was this part of me wanting or needing? And then, you know, send love to that part and do that kind of thing. But shame, it feels like it's made by two.
Yeah, it's made as a form of sort of like social training or social control. And I think it does need to be undone in connection. Because a big way to lower shame is when, you know, somebody, you say something that you feel ashamed about and the other person goes, what? You know, that's wonderful.
Yeah. Well, I always do that too. Yeah, exactly. So I suppose, yeah. So we could say, you know, connection is the antidote to shame.
Absolutely. And I think secure attachment, like knowing someone will love you no matter what you say to them. And also just, you know, pointing out that like these expectations or ideas are ridiculous and everybody's different, and it's, you know, important to find out who you are, not to try to be what everybody expects you to be or society tells you to be.
Absolutely. Now, you mentioned secure attachment, massive idea, and the holy grail, right? To feel securely attached. Not something I always experience myself, but I'm working on it. I mean, when you go from being insecurely attached to securely attached, how does
it really think of it that way. I think there are relationships where we have more or less security. And even if you're quite securely attached, you might end up like having parts of yourself come up that are like anxious because of the way a particular partner is dealing with you. So I think we have tendencies. Like my tendency is to be more anxious. I often date people whose tendency is to be more avoidant. You know, and those things get exacerbated
by
each other.
That fun little dynamic. Yeah.
But I mean, I think you can, like I have had one completely secure relationship with a partner, and I'm just like, I did it, you know, like it was amazing. Yay. I still feel it in my body, even though we're not together anymore. And it's like a foundational sense of security that helps me in all of the other relationships that I have, which don't have that level of security in them.
you still feel the sort of the calm in your body of knowing true love, essentially.
Yeah. True love, but also safe love, you know, which
safe love. Are they the same? No, wait, wait, are they? Wait, let's slow down here a minute. Okay. Safe, true, big words. Okay. I mean,
I think you can really deeply love a person and be loved by them, but you might not be able to help each other feel safe.
Yes. I mean, look, some people say it's not, if you have love that isn't safe, it's more like, you know, obsession. Mm. I don't know about that. I feel like love has many forms.
Absolutely. And this just happened to, you know, be both, which was, I felt very fortunate to have the experience.
Meaning safe, true, and exciting. Yeah. I just added a third one in because I felt it.
All just of
really, 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 really great. Well, I like what you're saying about having it in your body. And I like that because it's also a sort of, in a way, it invites a less greedy perspective around love, that it's not necessarily about, you know, working towards this one final triumphant thing, but more, you know, that we can have a collection of experiences and absorb into our body the ones that feel nourishing.
Yeah, I suppose the difficult. Idea. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no. Well, I was going to say it's like you want to absorb the nourishment, but not the toxicity.
Yeah. And I do feel like there's this idea that there's some place that we're trying, like there's a place that we're trying to get. And once we get there, we're there. And there's no there.
There ain't no there there.
There ain't no there there.
There ain't no there there. Oh, shit. Oh, shit. And yet, we want it, right? I mean, we want it.
We do want that. But I feel like wanting it actually gets in the way of getting what's available.
It's a very odd kind of mythic thing. I often think about that. You know, the end credits. I mean, I've just written a book that's really about this, that this arrival fallacy within relationships and my own codependency and, you know, learning to kind of work through it and actually be in the picture of your own life rather than sort of this voyeuristic thing of like, when do I put this picture together that equals that thing that is the end? And yet, why do you want the end? Because the end is death, right? So... It's a funny old thing, isn't it? It's a weird paradox, and it might be about just trying to outwit death.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's about that, like trying to create a myth. Yourself. So big. Prove yourself.
I think so much yes. of it is about proving ourselves to others. You know, it's like we all think that other people have it. We're like, now I have it too. Look, and you post your picture on Facebook.
you think like being in a couple is a lot about showing the world that you can do it?
Yeah, not just being in a couple, yeah. But being married, being, you know, just like all of the image of what it's supposed to look like. And then we just keep projecting that image where like, but there's turmoil and there's challenge, you know, and that's not what we're talking about a lot of times, that it just goes like this, you know, it doesn't just stay at this,
right, which would be very weird anyway. But yeah, it's a very kind of it's a deeply rooted myth.
Very.
There's a myth of okayness and that other people can get us there, and I think it's quite sad in a way that we have this set up, because then we end up feeling like we're inevitably going to disappoint each other,
and everyone feels like a failure.
Right, exactly.
Just so
how do we make each other feel like rock stars in relationship? Come on, Celeste. Well, how do we do this?
I mean,
this?
I've had tons of successful relationships.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
doesn't mean okay. like some of them persist to this day.
Scores of them.
Scores of them.
How many are there, for God's sake?
Including my one with my ex-husband who lives downstairs.
Yeah. 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 Okay. So we're defining successful relationships where you make each other feel really good.
Yeah. You have an ongoing loving connection, maybe attachment. Yeah. Maybe you have also romance and passion. Maybe you just have romance and passion, but not really attachment. But
you
have a wonderful time with the other person. And just because something needs to shift, it doesn't mean it makes everything that happened before that null and void. Like,
gosh, yes, absolutely. And I guess there we're talking about attachment, right? Because you have this idea of this is how we would be good together, right? I see us hand in hand, you know, on this beach, having a couple's date with so and so, whatever. Yeah, no, I think that's right. And being able to dismantle those images and look at what's really authentically there and build a new structure. And I think
you've had that experience, right, Jane? Like, you've been on a date holding someone's hand, and it was a couple's date, and the sun set, and you drank a bottle of wine, and you splashed in the waves. Like,
I mean, I want to say yes. I'm like, fuck, I better have had that date, man. Shit, have I? Listen, I'll tell you this: I've had a lot of good dates. I am not a deprived woman, you know, in any stretch of the imagination. But I do think, you know, relationships, successful relationships, feel to me like. They do feel like the holy grail. I mean, I certainly want to cultivate that in, you know, in all my relationships, a sort of, you know, state where we're just incredibly generous to each other. But I think it's really hard when you're in romantic relationships, when these needier parts get triggered and you go into the part of yourself that is the least magnificent, you know? And I mean, I just went through it and I just, you know, saw myself going into what I think of as like the abject, you know, the part of myself that just feels really like bloody minded and horrible. Mm. I feel like I'm horrible. I want to be horrible. I want to take you down with me, you know, and it's more under control than it used to be, but it's still there and may be there, you know, and I think it's hard, isn't it? And then you hurt the person that you love. And then we've got the work of repair. And do we have the energy for it? And do we have the skill set, you know?
Yeah. Well, firstly, I want to say not maybe, there will be. There always is there.
Mm. What, there is always the
hurt part.
The hurt, yeah. Yeah.
Hurt part. And so it's like when she comes up inside of me, which she has this week, it's been a rough week.
Mm,
and it's like the anxiety of like, oh, why did this person ghost me? And like, what did I do? Did I mess something up? You know? And then I'm just like, you're not everybody's flavor, Celeste. Like, you had an amazing connection. Like, remember that kiss, you know, like, and here's my hurt little girl going like, but how come everybody doesn't like me? And how come they don't like me forever?
Yes.
And I'm just like, I know, how come? But I just love her, like, and I get why she gets scared. And then I'm like, but the anxiety, I know, like, maybe I'll, you know, send too many texts or something, like, I'll do something out of that place of anxiety that I like was like, oh, I wish I didn't do that, you know?
Yeah,
also, I did, and I will.
Yes, 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 the human.
Yeah,
can't always be in the rock star, right? Sometimes it's just like, the vulnerable human. So how much of our work here is about repair? I mean, when you're working with couples, is what are we looking at mostly?
There's these so hurt parts in couples. Yeah. Work, there's so much repair, but mostly it's like, instead of saying like, I'm going to be totally responsible or fix or save that little part of you and like make it go away, you know, it's more like, no, it's going to come up in each of us and it's going to look differently. Like you and I, more anxious, we're going to feel like bad about the neediness, but like people who are more avoidant, they feel bad about like, you know, like taking away what they feel like they're supposed to give somebody, you know, it's like everybody's feels bad about some of the things
about who they are.
Yeah, exactly. To some degree, until we start to go, that's just the way that you're hurt. And that's the way I'm hurt. And these are the ways they kind of exacerbate each other. And you didn't do anything wrong. And I didn't do that. Mm. You know, like, we didn't create these things. But can we empathize when they happen? Can we repair when we kind of drop each other? You know, like, can we hold ourselves in those moments? Like, that's couples work. That's the repair side. And then there's the fun, you know, sexy parts too.
Right. So with the needy parts, I guess it's this sort of balancing act of being able to acknowledge each other's needy parts, do our best to meet the needs, but not get so sucked endlessly into that game. I mean, I know that there's some couples therapy out there that is all about, you know, just like, this is all about reparenting. It's all about restoring each other's sense of safety. And I don't know, when I first heard that, I thought it was a revelation because I was in a marriage where I wasn't feeling emotionally safe and it really appealed to me. But then there's that whole other side of being in a relationship, right? Which is the yeah, wanting to individuate, do your own thing, feel free. And I, you spoke about this in your book, I think it was in Making Love Real, the tension between the individualism and the secure attachment. And I love that you really bring both of those things into the picture, because they must both be important.
Well, we have to, because I've had so many couples where like one is more attachment oriented and the other is more individuation oriented. And if I was just an attachment helper, then I would ignore, like I would tell the person who needs individuation, no, no, there's something wrong with you. You have to prioritize this other thing that's less important to you, but more important to your partner. And to me, that's like saying, oh, half of the population or whatever percentage is anxious, like they're right.
Yeah.
And you're
yeah.
wrong. You know? Yeah, instead yeah. of saying like, no, we both want to be ourselves and we both want safety and we have different priorities or needs around those things. How do we try to make them work together as opposed to being at odds with each other?
So for couples at home who are not going to have the resources to find you, or just, you know, they're on the other side of the world, are there any kind of tips that you can share about how, around like communication or how to get started with, you know, getting real and doing this work?
Yeah, empathy. You know, it's the beat that's missed in repair more often than anything else. And empathy is where you actually, you don't just parrot back what somebody says, like in like nonviolent communication or something like that. But I hear you saying, you know, yeah. It's like you have to actually take a moment and realize like your partner's different from you. And to put yourself in their shoes, not think like, what would I do in this situation? But what does somebody who have their particular wounds and fears and needs, what's going on for them? And then you want to say it, you know, you want to say like, I get that when I, you know, need to ride my motorcycle 3 weeks out of, you know, the summer months, that you feel really alone and scared and you don't feel like you're prioritized for me. Or whatever it is, that's like the individuation moment versus the attachment moment, like to actually see that, like, what's wrong with you? How can you can't be more independent? Like, what's wrong with you? You don't care about anybody else but yourself. Those are the kinds of ways we shame individuation and attachment needs, instead of going like, wow, I can see like you really need this time to yourself, you know, and I get how important that is to you. And it's really hard on my nervous system, you know, or, you know, like I do want to express that part of myself and I can see how much it impacts you, right? Like to actually like honor that both of those things can be true at the same time and to empathize with the other person's experience instead of just presenting your case
yes.
and shaming
yes.
the other person for their needs.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like learning to not be so selfish, but not in a way that I was kind of taught, which is more like, you know, you stuff your own feelings. It's like, no, you have your own feelings, but they don't get to trump the feelings of the other.
Yeah. And maybe when everybody starts empathizing, then you start taking each other's feelings into account and you can see you have an impact, even if you wish you didn't, you know, and then you start to make better decisions that include everyone. You know, that doesn't mean that everything always works. Like sometimes people are too far apart on their needs for it to actually be compatible, but that's not somebody's fault and it's not a failure. And it doesn't mean they don't love each other.
So, I mean, you're obviously not working with couples, you know, coming from a place that we want everyone to stay together. What is your angle, you know, when you're working with couples? What are you wanting for them?
Yeah, to me, that's like focusing on the structure versus the connection. I do want every couple to have ongoing loving intimacy with each other, have ongoing attachment if that's important to them. But if it's not working for them to be in a romantic partnership, then maybe they need to shift into some other structure. And maybe they need a break in order to, like, you know, reorient around not needing all of those things from that particular person. But the way that people break up in this culture is so sad. And I did it so many times and it was like heart-wrenching and painful with people that I loved. And it was like, oh, this isn't working. I hate you. You fucked everything. You know, it's like, as opposed to like, wow, this just isn't compatible, you know, but I
right. So you mean like people break up and they're like, they think, oh, we're in a breakup. We're just throwing this whole thing in the trash.
Yeah. Like splitting up the friends and trashing each other you know what I mean? Like fighting over the kids and making them pawns in this situation.
I know what you mean. You know, when I was newly divorced, I was going out with new divorcees, sometimes still am, but, you know, they would just freely trash their ex-wives. Yeah. Needless to say, that was the last date.
Yeah.
Like, what is going on here? You know, like the level of unconsciousness is insane, you know?
Yeah, you're like, I'm next on the list to be trashed. So
I can't wait to be in her position. You know?
Exactly.
P.S. This is a really interesting conversation. You know, I can't wait to hear more about what went wrong in your marriage, you know?
Right.
yeah, no, I like that perspective, you know, it's like, what is good here? What can we preserve? What can we parlay or evolve in different ways? Now, when it comes to sex, I feel like broadly sex in marriage, broadly speaking, there are two schools of thought. One is, you know, you sort of let it go. Like if it's, I was just having lunch with a friend, she's like, and neither of us want to, we've been together for ages and it's quite nice. We don't want to. And I'm like, great. But she felt that sort of pressure a little bit, right? Some people think it's fine to just go with the flow. I kind of do. But there's a whole other school of thought, which is like, you should be having orgasms. You should be keeping it hot and spicy all the time. Like, how much should couples work on sex? Should they work on sex?
So again, I'll say people are different. For some people, sex is a very high priority, including myself. For other people, it's not, you know, they would rather garden together. So
yeah.
I just don't believe in should. And I don't believe one size fits all. When I have a couple in front of me, I'm like, what are your priorities for yourself? What are your priorities for yourself? I'm working with a new couple right now where he's very sexual and she has no interest. Like I even said, like, you know, go masturbate and see, it's been a really long time since she has. She's like, yeah, I did it. I can do it. Not really of interest to me, not a priority, you know? And so it's like, okay, so how do we work with those differences in needs and not, again, see, it's like nobody's failure, nobody's fault. You know, what are the different options that you have in that situation and how do you pursue those and take care of each other in the face of that, you know, or not, right? Like whether it's just feeling your disappointment and deciding you're not going to be sexual for the more sexual person, or, you know, outsourcing honestly and negotiating that in some way. Mm-hmm. I don't have an agenda for which of those you choose. I prefer that people don't choose stay and build resentment. I find that one to be quite toxic.
I think I'll just stay and be really, really unhappy and take it out on you.
Many people make that choice.
A lot of people make that choice, don't they?
Well, it's been
well modeled, right? It's been well modeled for us. We've seen
well modeled.
I mean, I think about this a lot that we don't have. I mean, we've got shows and movies, which we've already discussed a bit, are kind of problematic. We don't have a lot of good real life examples of really like amazing couples. It's certainly something I always feel on the lookout for. I'm always really thrilled when I meet. I mean, I build it up in my mind. I'm always like, they're such a great couple. And, you know, you find out, well, of course, there's all sorts of problems. But I love seeing good couples. I love seeing love. I love seeing people being respectful to each other and kind to each other and helping each other out. I want to see that modeled at large. And I just don't, I think, you know, we get given the parents that we're given and it's sort of random. It's just like, here are these two random people and they're going to be your gateway into the world and they're going to like inform your attachment patterns and they're going to, you know, and there you are.
You know what show I actually loved for that, which is sort of surprising? Mm. Did you ever watch that show, Madam Secretary?
No.
It's about a woman who is Secretary of State and her and her husband's relationship is actually awesome. Like there's individuation stuff, there's attachment, they don't agree on everything. When they communicate around it, they listen to each other and understand each other, but still advocate for themselves. Like I was like, wow, this is actually like really mature relating in just a show that's about political. I call it political porn, you know, like what if people actually did the right thing?
Oh, I love that. I love that.
I do love political porn. But it also had a really nice, solid relationship in it that I thought was like a good example.
Okay, that's beautiful. I'm gonna check out that show.
But I do, and I want to answer your question also about like,
yeah.
So if people do want to focus on sex and continue to have a thriving sex life, I think that the conversation that needs to be had is not the one that's usually had, right? Which is just like, what positions do you like? Hot tips, or just, I don't even think people really have a good conversation about it, period, you know? But there needs to be a conversation around like, what are the feelings that you want to have during sex? Mm-hmm. Like, what do you want to feel? And then what do you want to do that gives you those feelings? And then you need to teach each other how to do them and see, like, are you up for that? What are your boundaries? Because sometimes people don't want to do everything that their partner wants, or sometimes you have to find a different pathway to that particular feeling if the one that you like the best is your partner is not up for, you know?
So it's, I mean, you and I touched on this in a conversation before, but this to me brings up quite complex mapping, because when I think about what I want, it's various. It's not just one thing, you know. I was thinking about this, you know, I want to have an adventure. I want to have a spiritual connection. I want to feel super hot. I want to have intimacy. I want to be surprised. I mean, that's just five things off the bat.
Yeah.
Like, do we just like sit down and just make a map and make a map of them? And like, is that how it goes?
Oh, I mean, only if you want to have hot sex for your lifetime.
Let me think about that.
If not, I would skip it.
I mean, no. You know, I like that resentment model that we were talking about earlier. I think I'll go for that.
I do think it's an ongoing conversation, right? It's let's do something adventuresome, you know, and this is what feels adventuresome to me. And these are the things you could say, or this would be ways you could surprise me. And it's like, even if you tell someone how to surprise you, if they do it well at a totally different time, it still works.
Yes. Yes. True. Like saying boo.
It's not that you told them to say boo. It's like they said it, you know, right when you came out of the shower.
And it's so good. Yeah, no, I love that. I like the idea of setting up more games. That's super sweet. Mm. I feel like I always have like millions of questions to ask you, and I don't want to, you know, drive you crazy. But I do want to, before we wrap up, I want to talk about opening relationships. It feels like it's in the ether right now. I'm hearing a lot of, maybe it's my age or whatever, but there are a lot of couples who are like, we think we're going to open the relationship and everyone's scared and it might work and it might not. Like, gosh, I mean, how much are you seeing of this, and what do you feel about it? What are the success rates?
I think that the funny thing about open versus closed relationships and the way that people think about them is nobody ever says, you know why my relationship was ruined? Monogamy. If it hadn't been for monogamy, I would be like, good point. You know what doesn't work very well for long-term relating? Monogamy. You know? I feel like open relationships get put on this totally different, like they're on the grill. Like you have to like prove that it's going to work. You know, it's like how many monogamous relationships don't work. I had a therapist one time. They're like, I was talking about being in an open relationship. They're like, well, that can be really challenging. And I'm like, yeah, except you know what's really challenging to my relationship right now? Monogamy. Because I'm not getting enough sex and I'm about to kill my partner, you know? So open relating might actually save the relationship, where for sure it's not going to last under these circumstances. So I think that's the first thing I want to do is like, put both of them on the hot seat.
Wait, what do you mean put both?
Monogamy and...
I see. Got it. Yeah.
Like, do they work? Yeah. No. And yes. Like, sometimes they work and sometimes they don't.
Yes. So we just have to try it out?
And I think when you try it out, you don't want to dive in the deep end. Like, a lot of people make the mistake if they're already in a monogamous relationship and they're trying to move into open relating from monogamy. Like, you don't just like go have sex with someone else.
Right.
Like maybe you walk around together and you like check out people together and you say like, they're attractive. Yeah. And then you go, okay, that's like, right. Like even that.
And you like weep for four nights. I can't believe it. You said she was pretty.
Exactly. You might. You might.
Yeah.
And that's okay, right? Like, but that's like,
is it though? I mean, I wonder about that with myself. I just think, God, I don't know if I'd want to go through all that jealousy. And what do you think about jealousy? Is that something you can make progress with? Could I just transcend it?
No. I mean, I
damn you for your honest answer. Yeah.
I really don't like that. I don't like those ideas of like jealousy is bad or something like that. Like I'm a very jealous, possessive person. And I feel like I get like poly shamed, you know?
What do you mean?
Like polyamorous people like shame me for like not being.
Oh,
cool.
You're not allowed to. Oh, I see. Interesting. You know, right. You're supposed to be just so groovy. And,
and so like, why are you so possessive? Like what's with you? You know? And it's like, why am I so possessive? Because I have abandonment trauma.
Yeah.
And when my partner wants to be with other people, I get terrified. And I spent a long time in an open marriage, terrified. And then I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. You know, this actually isn't working for me. And I had to create a structure of dating and relating that worked and fit my nervous system. But for some people.
But you're not monogamous.
But I'm not in a primary. I don't do primary, what I call primary possessive partnership anymore.
Because that brings up too much jealousy because there'll be other people around and you've got your strong sex drive. So you found a structure that you can have the sex drive. Yeah. You describe it to me, please.
My structure is that I consider myself to be dating multiple people.
Yeah.
I don't have a boyfriend or a long-term like primary partner because as soon as I put like all my attachment eggs in one basket.
Yes.
I go haywire. And if I don't do that, I'm good. Except for with this one guy, I was able to do it for very specific reasons and an amount of time, et cetera. But now, you know, so I spent, when I would try to do primary possessive partnership, I literally 75% of my year was trigger.
Wow. That's rough. Now, it's rough on the nervous system.
Now I've like, what, 3% of my year is trigger? Five, like, it's like I'm a different person. So I just found the structure that fits me. It's not the right structure for, you know, it'll be the right structure for some other people. Some people need monogamy. Some people need open relating. Some people need monogamish. What's hard is when people who are together need very different things.
Yes. When you talk about triggers, I realize we can't avoid being triggered, but are we looking to just absolutely minimize that because we want to protect the nervous system? We don't think we can work through it. We just think it's such sort of basic stuff.
I've put that as my number one personal priority because I thought if I kept getting that triggered, I was just going to end up with like cancer or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was just my experience.
Yeah.
Some people are willing to do a lot more trigger in order to try to preserve certain relationships that they really find important. Like, again, I don't have an agenda for what your priorities are. I try to help people figure it out. Mine is to have a low trigger because I spent enough of my life in trigger and I did all the growing and the practicing with my jealousy. And, you know, I've watched my partner have sex with other people in front of me. I've done all the things.
I really want to go out for drinks with you
This is what works best for me
through
trial and error, but I want to help people like figure out for themselves what their priorities are and be really conscious about when they're taking those kinds of risks and listening to themselves. And you know, is it like some people just choose I'm gonna do the 75% trigger, like okay, but they're doing it consciously.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like you're talking about taking a lot of responsibility in relationship, and this sounds grown up, and I love the spirit within which you work. It feels like there's so much integrity. I really, really respect it, and I think lucky couples and individuals working with you.
Thank you.
I'm sure you're very busy out there in San Francisco.
Well, now I'm mostly training coaches in my method.
Yeah. So tell us a bit about that. How's the kind of greater scheme working and how can people find you and, you know, how can we work with you?
Danielle and I had so many clients in our practice and we like would feel guilty turning them away. So we actually started training coaches so that we could give our overflow to them. Now we give everyone to them. We're not really taking new clients personally at this point. And the training is like a year-long training and people can start doing some practice, you know, seeing some clients after 6 months, but you were really training people to help people in the realm of emotional and erotic intimacy. So it's very focused, it's very practical, very experiential, you know, and it has this attitude towards it, which is like, our goal is to help people figure out who they are, not to impose a structure of society, whether it's sexually, relationally, emotionally, like what do they want for themselves? And then we try to help them get that in their life. That's kind of the basis of Somatica. And we are really specialized in sexuality because it's not a place where you can get a lot of good help in general, especially like experiential, practical, in a safe container.
Therapy. Yeah, this is very, sounds very integrated.
Thank you. I like that word. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I agree with that. I've, you know, I'm always kind of looking into these worlds of sexual healing, and there's a lot of interesting stuff out there, but a lot of it does feel rather sort of, solipsistic or a bit rooted in trauma in some kind of way. And obviously trauma is always in the picture, but I feel like this model feels, you know, open and breezy and relational and a good mixture of kind of academic and yeah, body-based. It sounds like really good stuff.
And it's really informed. I mean, we help people map their triggers and we help people learn, you know, all those things. So we really try to cover those bases.
Yeah. You can't try and cut out trauma, can you? Damn it. Why wouldn't that stuff just go away? It's so annoying. So just tell me, you know, on a personal level before we wrap up, what is your greatest hope for this work?
I think it's really what we've been talking about is not imposing whoever we are as, like, you know, a practitioner or a coach, not imposing our idea about how to live a life onto other human beings. I was born in a little bit of like a hippie cult, and there was, you know, cults have impositions, but religions, societies have impositions about the way that they think a person is supposed to be. And so I'm just like anti that. Like, I hope that the world starts to see that people are different and that's what makes it beautiful. And that if we can help each person find their true expression, everyone is happier.
I couldn't agree more, I have to say. So tell us how to find Somatica.
Yeah, so it's somaticainstitute.com. Somatica is Somatica. And our training is completely online. So it's an international training that people are taking from all over the world. Amazing community. And that's where you can find a coach for yourself also, in addition to finding the training if you feel like becoming a coach.
Yay. Thank you so much. Such a pleasure to have you today.
So great to talk with you.